Ireland was always in an unbalanced relationship with Britain, the bigger neighbor. So we needed large friends to help us. And that was Irish America. There wouldn't have been a 1916 without Irish America, without the Irish in New York. There wouldn't have been peace in Ireland without Irish America, and particularly without our friends in Washington.
That was Ted Smith, and this is Irish Stew, the podcast for the global Irish nation.
This episode of Irish Stew is sponsored by Irish Examiner USA, a great source for Irish-centric news from both sides of the pond. Politics, business, sports, nightlife, arts and culture, and more. It's all at IrishExaminerUSA.com.
Hi, this is Martin Nutty, and you're listening to the Irish Stew podcast. I'm joined here today by my partner in crime, my co-host, John Lee. Hey, John, who do we have on the podcast today, sir?
Well, Martin, let me set it up by saying I've been traveling along what I call New York's Irish Trail for about a dozen years. And along the way, there's some prominent people that keep popping up in all the right places and saying all the right things. And, you know, if this person lives in your neighborhood, you may get to sit down for a cup of coffee with them. And our next speaker fits that bill. He went from rural to urban to international. From leadership roles in diplomacy to C-suite roles in Fortune 500 companies, and to a rich post-corporate career in board service, writing, community service, and community leadership. He earns the highest praise a New Yorker can give to another New Yorker. Ted Smith, you are a mensch, and welcome to Irish Stew.
Thank you very much, John, for that embarrassingly nice introduction. And Martin, congratulations to you both on the quality of your podcast. I'm really enthralled how you're using technology to nurture not just the Irish in New York, but the global Irish community. And, you know, just delighted to join you this morning and look forward to our chat.
You know, Martin, I said Ted said all the right things, and he starts off right at the top saying good things about Irish Stew. He says all the right things. Ted, you know, I look back at my career, which has been kind of all over the place, not as at the rarefied levels you've traveled in. And sometimes I have a little bit of a difficulty kind of finding the common thread. And then I really realize there is, despite all the different job descriptions, there has been a common thread in my career. So for you, how do you think of yourself? Diplomat, business person, volunteer, writer, community leader? What's your common thread?
Well, you know, life is something of a random walk. You start out in a little village on a farm in County Westmeath in Ireland in 1949, and you keep on going on, one step after another. I guess I was a joiner from an early age, but also an introvert who had to struggle to join. And, you know, at home when I was a member 9 or 10, we'd have whist drives. We were a small Protestant community in rural Ireland, and we socialized amongst ourselves, as did the Catholics on their side. So the whist drives were an opportunity to meet adults, meet other young people, and to show, you know, that you could participate. There were church choirs, there were church outings. A lot of our life was organized around these events. We had an annual outdoor services on the Hill of Tara and around the ruins of Clonmacnoise Monastery. Church of Ireland was trying to lay claim to the early Christian Ireland. Bit of a stretch, but that was in the tradition. So as I was thinking about, you know, my early years recently and what motivates one, I came across Seamus Heaney's reference to Paul Muldoon's first pamphlet published in Belfast in 1971. It's called Knowing My Place. And he writes, it's a punning title, which is at once humble and arrogant, slyly elusive to what was expected of the minority to which he belonged, obviously the Catholic minority in Northern Ireland, and genuinely in sympathy with the idea that everything had its place, art, love, politics, local affections, cultural heritage, and for that matter, the place where a world doubles its meaning, where a line ends on the page. So I've always been, I guess, looking for my place and finding it in different places, going from boarding school, which was a bit of a Dickensian do the boys institution, to really finding my place in Trinity College Dublin, studying history and political science and getting involved in politics. And 68, boy, were there politics on an international scale. And then with the conflict breaking out in Northern Ireland, we were at the center of it all. So in some sense, my life has revolved around trying to see what one can do to resolve questions of conflict and injustice wherever I've been, and to see what I can do.
Ted, 1950s Ireland, which you alluded to at the start, was a pretty tough place. From what I understand, close to about 10% of the population immigrated at that time. Economically, things were difficult, but you also alluded to the fact that your growing up experience was almost sectarian in a way. There wasn't a lot of crossover between the Catholic and Protestant communities in County Westmeath. Is that a fair assessment? You know, what was the Protestant experience per se growing up in this relatively recently independent country? Like, there is always this thought that when the Republic became independent, that it was going to be Rome rule. So as a member of the Protestant community, did you and your family feel somewhat put upon in this new Ireland?
It's a very good question, Martin. You know, the Smiths, my father was a Smith from the Palatine settlement in Limerick, and my mother was an Irvine from Cavan, which of course was part of Ulster. But family wasn't in any hurry to join many of the Anglo-Irish families who fled to England after independence. Their roots had been in Ireland for 200 years, and they were Irish Protestants, not British Protestants. They sent their children to Irish schools, not British ones, and they listened to Radio Éireann more than the BBC Home Service. And by the 50s, they were prosperous enough Church of Ireland farmers, land rich, of course cash poor, no penny for anything extra. But socially and economically, we fell between, I would call it, the big house Anglo-Irish ascendancy and the Catholic Irish majority. You know, the gentry in our parish would sit at the front of the church once or twice a year, and we'd see them, you know, maybe out at fox hunts. But we didn't mix socially with them or with Catholic families. And the reason for that not mixing was the Catholic priests rigorously insisted on following the Naitamara Decree of 1907, which not only insisted the Catholic partner in a marriage vow to bring children up as Catholics, but the non-Catholic partner had to make the same vow. And this requirement did cause massive resentment amongst Protestants, as one of the main determinations of Protestant parents to live religiously and segregated lives, so their children would marry, quote, one of our own, unquote. But, you know, I have to say, you know, we were obviously privileged, and we were very much, you know, accepted into the Irish community. You know, De Valera, a lot of people talk about the special position of the Catholic Church. He actually was trying to set limits on what the Catholic Church wanted at the time. The demand from Pope Pius XI at the time was to make Catholicism the state religion, which had happened in some countries like Spain. But Dev didn't want to go that far, so he recognized a special position of the Catholic Church, but he also recognized the other churches. So it, you know, in Ireland at the time, it was unfortunate we were separate and segregated, but there were good relations, nevertheless, between Catholics and Protestants in the Republic.
Ted, as you move from the rural to the urban to Trinity College, and then looking ahead to diplomacy, how did this dynamic that you've had in your own hometown play out in the next couple of stages in your life? This Protestant Catholic dynamic. And
my sense of place exponentially expanded when I enrolled in Trinity College Dublin. You know, it was traditionally a Protestant garrison, if you like. The Catholic hierarchy required any Catholic who went there to get special permission from their bishop And that ban was formally lifted in 1972, the year I graduated. So we had a mix of Northern and Southern Catholics and Protestants and Brits as well. And it was something of a petri dish where we could participate in the emerging civil rights movement in Northern Ireland and join, you know, the struggle for equality and justice for Catholic nationalists in the North. And being Irish in 1968 became a much broader thing. It meant many young people embracing what we call today diversity and equality and political expression, freedom of expression. So we were in the beginning of building a new Ireland. And indeed, at that time, John Hume was writing about that new Ireland in the Irish Times. So it was a very exciting time. And I became head of the what is the oldest university debating society in the world, the College Historical Society, in 1971-72. And I remember we normally met on Wednesdays, but after the Bloody Sunday, the previous Sunday in Derry, we adjourned our meeting in respect for the dead, for those who've been murdered. And I took part in the march in the British Embassy, which of course ended up in it being burned. So these were very dramatic and heady times where history was being made, not just in the classroom, but on the streets.
If I'm hearing you correctly, Ted, you're clearly sympathetic to John Hume and the Catholic minority in Northern Ireland while you were at Trinity College. But as I recall it, Trinity itself, to some degree, was not a fully integrated institution at that time. So what was the thread there that caused this crossover?
Well, people were very welcoming and very open to each other. A lot of folks, this was 68 when I went to Trinity, and there were many demonstrations in the front square. People had come back from the Sorbonne and from Columbia and were full of the revolution, general revolutionary talk. There were a lot of Marxists and Trotskyites. It turned out the board of Trinity College considered paving over the cobblestones in case they were used in riots. So it was a time of ferment. And, you had Burn Tollet March in 69. I didn't get there, but a number of my fellow students did. And famously, Bernadette Devlin came to one of our debates and was just wowed us all, won us all over. John Hume spoke. And, his message that difference is the essence of humanity and it should never be a cause for conflict just resonated with all of us. I think it was my first day in Trinity. I was sitting on the dining hall steps wondering who I would meet. And I sat down beside another guy who I recognized from playing rugby against him. His name was Dick Spring. And he had just entered Trinity as well. So we talked a bit about rugby and then we started up a friendship. But it was that sort of a place where, for those of you who don't know who Dick Spring was, he went on later to become Taoiseach of Ireland, was very much involved in the peace process as leader of the Labour Party. And he did, of course, play rugby for Ireland. I'm afraid my rugby playing days ended playing for the University of Lisbon in Portugal when I was a diplomat there. Wasn't of a very high caliber, I can assure you.
So you go into Trinity and play some rugby. Obviously, you're studying politics and history. Was the game plan always to go into the Department of Foreign Affairs? Young, starry-eyed students, why not go the electoral politic route rather than the civil servant route?
It's a good question, Martin. I've always asked myself since. I had no connections into it. I didn't really know of any Protestant Irish who had been elected. In fact, I was the first member of my family to enter the Irish public service. So, most of them went into the professions or farmers or whatever. So I was branching out already in a sense. And I was intrigued by what was going on with potential entry into the European Union and, of course, by the Northern Ireland crisis, and felt that the way I could probably, most easily influence things might be through the diplomatic service. Freddie Boland was also the former ambassador to the UN from Ireland and Secretary General of the Department of Foreign Affairs, was the Chancellor of Trinity. And he influenced me both personally, but also by his own record, that the diplomatic service would be an interesting way to influence Irish politics and Ireland's place in the world, as we were very conscious of the fact that we had to fight, punch above our weight, being a small country, an island behind an island. This, of course, is long before we joined the European Union. And I grew up with an impoverished farm because we were subject to the cheap food policy of England. The English farmers themselves had farm support prices, but we didn't. So I felt there was a lot of work that one could add in the Department of Foreign Affairs. Having said that, I had no guarantee I would get in. It was very competitive at the time. And so like everybody else in Trinity, I applied for, you know, whatever jobs were coming up. And at the time, that mostly meant, you know, going overseas. The banks and various British institutions would come to Trinity and recruit people. So I went for second interviews with the Ford Motor Company in labor relations. I could have been involved in those labor disputes, Lloyds Bank. To be honest, mostly I went because it was a free trip to London. And that was a great thing. But yeah, I did get accepted to the Department of Foreign Affairs. And that, you know, became a very exciting part of my life for 16 years.
You know, Ted, you're really getting into kind of some of the core issues that we look at, that sort of global Irish nation idea. I would say punching above its weight is the number one expression I've heard in the last 12 years in people discussing Ireland, from philanthropy to culture to that kind of soft diplomatic power. But I'd like to kind of get, you know, kind of take it back to you personally. In your first post in internationally, as you are now living in other countries and have that experience of an Irish person living abroad, and sometimes I've heard a kind of new sense of being Irish emerges when you're not in Ireland. So if you could just kind of, what's a little bit of the kind of the personal transition for you as you find yourself living in other countries?
That's a good insight, John. George Bernard Shaw, and he was John Bull's Other Ireland, had a character say, "I had to leave my country in order to know what my country was." And certainly we all of us have that tug when we leave Ireland. We are, you know, you're homesick for Ireland. And yet, after a while, you become this sort of permanent expat. And we're in this in-between world. I think Elizabeth Bowen said she only felt at home somewhere on the boat between Holyhead and Dunleary. So we're a little bit in between. But yeah, my first posting was a semi-foreign posting. It was as a delegate to the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe, big East-West conference, and we were headquartered in Geneva. Then I was posted to Portugal during the revolution, which was an amazing time. Well, if you can imagine it, Henry Kissinger had written off Portugal as going communist and had given up on it, whereas the Social Democrats of Europe, and I suppose at heart I'm would be a European Social Democrat, like Palm of Sweden, Willy Brandt of Germany, decided it was worth fighting for. And they hung in there when eventually free elections were held. The Social Democratic candidate beat the communist candidate. And, Portugal was saved for democracy. And then I worked with a lot of journalists at that time. And as a result of which, when the press and information job opened up in America, I was asked if I would take that on. You know, again, life's a random walk. I had no idea where I was going next. I was enjoying myself in Portugal, fantastic place, wonderful people, interesting political situation. When I get a call saying, you know, would you go to New York? I said, well, give me 2 minutes and I'll come back to you with an answer. I think I probably said no minutes. The answer is yes. Fantastic opportunity, 1976, to take on that role.
Ted, if I can ask, that's a fairly dramatic transition from a posting in Portugal to a posting in Washington, D.C. In my understanding of the world of diplomacy, clearly being involved in America would be kind of a plum assignment. And indeed, I think that time, the mid-70s, the beginning of the Carter presidency, had to be an interesting point in time. But also on top of that, things in Northern Ireland at the time were in a bit of a stalemate. People were dying. There didn't seem to be any movement. My sense is the British government were just throwing up their hands and saying something, well, that's the Irish for you.
Yep.
So my understanding of that point in time was the Irish government basically made a decision that said we need to move things forward somehow into Northern Ireland from this horrible, you know, violent conflict and take some control. And the only way we feel that we can leverage that is to basically ingratiate, it's probably the wrong word, ingratiate ourselves with powerful American politicians that can lean on Britain using the quote-unquote special relationship. Is that a fair understanding?
That is a fair understanding, Martin. Very fair. You know, Ireland was always in a unbalanced relationship with Britain as the bigger neighbor. So we needed large friends to help us. And that was Irish America. You know, as Joe Lee pointed out, there wouldn't have been a 1916 without Irish America, without the Irish in New York. There wouldn't have been peace in Ireland without Irish America, and particularly without our friends in Washington, the Four Horsemen, Tip O'Neill, Senator Kennedy, Hugh Carey, and Senator Pat Moynihan, who worked with John Hume, successive Irish governments, to influence presidents like Jimmy Carter, who had just been elected when came to America, and subsequently Ronald Reagan, obviously Bill Clinton, who did the most for peace. So, yes, one British minister, Thatcher, was once asked, indeed, why she signed the Anglo-Irish Agreement in 1985 when people, her loyalist friends, were criticizing her for it. And she said, the Americans made me do it. And, you know, Reagan leaned on her because Tip O'Neill leaned on him. So it's, you know, who your friends are and when they stand up for you. There's an interesting side story about, you know, anybody who's thinking about their careers and where they're going next. Do have friends, do have mentors. And when I was in Portugal, as I said, all these journalists came to cover the revolution. And one of them came to cover it for what was then the London Times, a journalist called Robert Fisk. And he went to the British Embassy and they threw him out because he'd been writing stories critical of the British Army in Northern Ireland. So he came to the Irish Embassy and we became fast friends. And I took him around the country in the embassy car. And he wrote about every story and about the revolution in 2 weeks. What I didn't know after many years later was that when he left, he didn't just write a letter of thanks to my bosses in the Department of Foreign Affairs. He got his editor, Rhys Mogg, to write to the Irish Foreign Minister saying what a wonderful guy I was. And that was one of the reasons why I was offered the job in New York. So, you know, your friends can do things for you. You, in turn, should do things for your friends. And the letter of thanks, I mean, it's a small point in everything, but is very important. So that's really how I ended up in New York. It's really how I met my wife, Mary Breasted. We've been married for 41 years and carved out a new life and got involved in the effort by Ireland to use the Irish-American and American connection to bring peace and justice to Ireland. And the media was a big part of that. My job was to engage with the media, the New York Times in particular, which then had a very strong editorial influence long before social media on what governments did. Karl Mayer was the editorial page writer that I became a very, very close friend, and Bob Semple, the foreign editor. These were people I played squash with, we drank with, and they were sympathetic to the situation in Ireland. They got it, they understood it, that there were wrongs that had to be addressed. And the British needed to do something about it and not just pretend they were neutral between two sides. They were clearly neutral on the side of the Unionists until that began to change in the Anglo-Irish Agreement and then, of course, with the Good Friday Agreement.
So you refer to a Rhys Mogg. Is that a relation to the much vilified Rees Mogg that was found slumping in the House of Parliament about a year or so ago?
You're absolutely right,
Jacob
Martin.
Rees Mogg?
Yeah, that's his father, who was actually a much better chap than the son.
But I just want to kind of flash forward a little bit, and we will return to the American political discussion because I think it's pertinent given the fact that we're recording this on January 29th. So 1988, if I'm correct, maybe 87, you leave the Department of Foreign Affairs and you make a transition into the corporate life. That's a massive change. You've devoted, 16 or so years of your life, to diplomacy. You've, played, a role in bringing peace to Ireland, the beginnings of peace to Ireland with the Anglo-Irish Accord. So why leave that behind just when you're, really starting to, achieve big time things in the world of diplomacy?
Great question. I keep asking myself that today. And very few other people have done that. It's much more common now for people to come and go within the public service and the private sector. One of the reasons was my wife, who is American, was feeling homesick for America. We'd gone back to Dublin in 82, worked with two Taoiseach then, Charlie Haughey and Garrett Fitzgerald, and then went to the embassy in London. And I knew I really wouldn't be due another posting back in America for quite a few years. And my life would take me elsewhere around the world. And one of the disadvantages of the diplomatic service is you move every 4 years. That's okay for the diplomat, but it's very hard on the spouse and the family. So much so that today, where both spouses tend to work, sometimes the spouse doesn't go out on the second tour, or one spouse takes a leave of absence from work, etc. So it's a bit of a juggle. You're constantly, on the road. And so that was in my mind as well, with three young children. And I'd met Tony O'Reilly, had helped him to set up the Ireland Fund back in New York when we were there, and also the Ireland Funds of Great Britain. And he offered me a job working for Heinz. I knew I'd still be able to keep in touch with Ireland because of the Ireland Funds. I went on the board of that. And I felt that I might learn something about the world if I went into business, that the public sector was one part of society, a very important part, but that needed to understand more about the wider world. And, when I was talking about this, somebody said, well, do you want to serve God or mammon? Meaning, did I want to do good or be in business? I was frankly puzzled about the question because, yeah, I wanted to do good, but I thought, if business and the public sector can create wealth together, and that's the source of our economy. And, I still working on that because there are two types of capitalism. Obviously, there's casino capitalism and there is stakeholder capitalism. And the two of them tend to be a little bit at war. But to the extent we can create value for everybody in society through business, that to me is a great objective. So yes, I wanted to explore that. Heinz was a way to do that, based in Pittsburgh, beautiful city, to live in, to grow up in, wonderful people. So that was a big part of my life. I mean, I slightly joke about this because later I went on to work for S&P Global, McGraw-Hill Education. But people say, well, are you writing your memoirs? I said, well, I've written the title. So that's a big advance. But the title would be something like God, Ketchup, and AAA.
Ted, I'm going to circle back just a second on the diplomatic question. I really have met nothing but outstanding people in the diplomatic corps here in New York, and a little bit at the embassy the embassy in D.C. I've watched that rhythm of life for them. I hate to start thinking that they're going to move out, and I've noticed some of them, they take to it. Some of them, this is the rhythm. It's time to move on to the next thing. But I can see how it must be quite a challenge.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a challenge. And as I say, particularly hard for the kids who make friends and so forth. I think, you know, if you keep a place in Dublin, if you're both from Dublin or Ireland, then it's maybe easier. Maybe you send, but sending the kids back to boarding school in Ireland must be hard too. Oh, it's gotten a little bit easier with international travel, but this year of COVID hasn't made it easier either.
I think that's a good point. The couples, the families I've known are always been, they've been Irish, you know, and one of them moves along with the other one.
Yeah.
I just want to, you know, thinking of your diplomatic career and serving God or serving mammon question, what did you bring into the corporate world of value that is consistent with your work in the diplomatic world?
That's a very good question. Somebody at Heinz asked me, was I ready to make, you know, the transition to the tough world of business? And I reminded them about the old joke of somebody saying, what's the difference between, you know, the public sector and the private sector? And the answer was, in the private sector, it's dog eat dog. But in the public sector, it's just the opposite. So there. Okay, thanks for the laugh.
Took me a minute.
But, you know, they're both very competitive. And I'd certainly worked very closely with the IDA, the Industrial Development Authority, to try and bring business investment from America to Ireland as part of my job. It wasn't just about Northern Ireland and peacekeeping, but it was about inward investment. And so I knew a lot of the business folks who worked with them, understood the importance of the corporate world. Initially, I went to work as head of government affairs and of, you know, press relations. And that was easy for me because I knew Washington inside out. And as a food company, we didn't have many issues. Food and Drug Administration, a few other things. Dolphin Safe was a big part of it. We had a tuna company, Astarchus Tuna. I've written about this in Irish Central. I won't bore you with the details here, but suffice to say, I went to then Senator Biden, and it turned out his daughter Ashley was very engaged. I think she must have been 11 at the time. And so he was a big supporter of our Dolphin Safe legislation to prevent the setting of nets on dolphins in order to scoop up the tuna underneath. So that was, you know, easy for me to make that transition there. Later, I became chief administrative officer in charge of global human relations. And, the CEO said to me, I know you don't have a background in human relations, but I think you have a great feel for people and for recruiting people and finding the right people. He said, I believe in fitting the person to the job and not the job to the person. Which is, you know, some business people have that approach. But I was, you know, the key was I was just willing to keep learning. I think all of us, we have to learn something new every day. And I was just interested in this whole world of profit and how you keep a balance between one type of, you know, interest and another. The shareholders are meant to be supreme. You know, the old approach was, you know, What's the purpose of business? The purpose of business is to maximize returns for shareholders. The Business Roundtable recently came out in Washington and said, no, actually, it's to serve stakeholders, whether they are shareholders, there's a customer, there's the community, and there are the employees. Now, that's a much harder balance. It's a very interesting balance. When you think about it, where's the long-term value in a corporation?
I couldn't agree with you more that maintaining a learning mindset is kind of key to building career. And I'm also curious, obviously, when you went to work at Heinz, Tony O'Reilly was then CEO, and he is clearly in the business world in Ireland a force of nature, a dominant personality. I wonder what your learning experience was when he was guiding Heinz, and I know he spent about 20 years there.
Yeah, Tony couldn't have been more supportive, setting out to make me successful, introduced me to everybody. I participated in all the senior executive meetings, board of directors. He was what I guess anybody would call a player coach. He brought the same competitive instincts to business and the boardroom as he did to the sports field, to rugby. And, you know, we traveled the world together. It was a great insight into business and how it needed to work. His insights into people were extraordinary. His assessments of them, how to bring out the best in them. And of course, his communication skills were without parallel. So it was, yeah, it was a very exciting time. I spent 10 years when he was CEO, and then I stayed on for 10 more years with his successor, Bill Johnson.
My experience with Ireland, an understanding of Tony O'Reilly's contribution to Ireland, was he was kind of considered to be an exemplar of success in the corporate world. And obviously he's had some difficulties post the financial crisis, to the point that my read of it is sometimes is that people, you know, some people in Ireland take a almost gleeful view, kind of express a certain amount of schadenfreude at his downfall. You think that's a fair reading? And what's your read of how Irish people deal with the corporate world, how comfortable or uncomfortable they are? And I'm just kind of alluding to your fact of, you know, the corporate world is not just about maximizing shareholder profit. It needs to be about more than that.
You talk about Global Ireland. Tony was one of the first pioneers of a Global Ireland. He made it easy for many other people to follow. He established the Irish in the forefront of business in Britain as head of the Heinz company there, which was the most profitable part of Heinz in the world, and then became present CEO of Heinz, a very reputable global company, and joined a number of boards. So he really did help Ireland, the Ireland funds. He helped to bring peace to Ireland through the Ireland funds. And I think it was a great shame when a number of the banks, particularly Allied Irish Bank, insisted on every last penny being paid back when many others were forgiven their debts. And I think that was unfair. Tony had guaranteed personally a lot of the loans to keep Waterford Wedgwood going. He wanted to keep the workforce intact in Ireland. He believed in Ireland, and that may have cost him his financial position. He's still, in my view, a great Irishman. And we owe him a great deal. Certainly, I owe him a great deal. Do the Irish people take any pleasure in his downfall? No, most don't. Most people are very fond of Tony O'Reilly. They do believe he wanted to do the best for Ireland. And he always had the green jersey on.
Appreciate that, Ted. I'm gonna go back just a little bit in the conversation. I love the image of the four horsemen and hearing the name Tip O'Neill again, and envisioning a time in politics when Tip O'Neill could be kind of strong-arming Ronald Reagan in a charming manner, and then Ronald Reagan putting the pressure in his his charming way into Margaret Thatcher. It speaks of a different time in American politics. And Martin and I were talking about this before the call.
Yes, the year of Tip O'Neill in politics was a different time. The Speaker of the House still had a lot of power and could still get the votes together. And when you think of the four horsemen, the power they had across the aisle was amazing. I do think that there were differences and so forth, but Senator Kennedy worked with a lot of different politicians to get great things achieved. It nevertheless, I think under President Reagan, leaving Ireland aside, I think we began to see the move towards away from the vision of America that LBJ and FDR had espoused of a more equal society. And I think from the 1980s up to the present time, we've seen the rich get much richer and everybody else get much poorer, to an extent where it's Oxfam recently calculated that the 85 richest people are richer than the 3.5 billion poorest people in the world. And that to me is absolutely shocking and needs to be addressed.
So I'm going to flash forward to the current period now. And I think it would be fair to say that the median of Irish politics is certainly left of center by American standards. And the current Republican Party, which had been, let's say, back in certainly immediately post-World War II, was kind of the party of the Boston Brahmins, if you will. But now we see in the Republican Party these Irish names, Mitch McConnell, Kevin McCarthy, Mick Mulvaney, Kellyanne Conway, Katie McInerney. Irish America was traditionally very tightly bound to democratic politics. Now that's no longer the case. What are the implications for the Irish government in this, let's say, more rightward tilt to American politics and the shift of the traditional Irish American community over to Republican politics?
I think Irish America is still a swing constituency in American politics. You remember back in for Eisenhower, more Irish Americans voted for Eisenhower than for his opponent. So it's not a new thing. And indeed, but the Kennedy election was close enough. And there were a lot of Irish who voted for Nixon. So it has been a swing vote, and we have to fight for every vote if we're a Democrat. I mean, I'm biased, and so on the Irish for Biden committee, and we realized early on that we had to persuade some people who had voted for Trump last time around to come back to the Democratic Party this time. And you try to think what could persuade them. Well, you know, one of the powers of persuasion is relatability, and there was nothing more relatable than Joe Biden and his Irish Catholic upbringing and his faith. And even though some bishops, some bishops were criticizing his legal position on abortion, even though he's opposed to it personally, we did succeed. President Biden did succeed in attracting just about a majority of Irish Catholics, whereas in the previous election 4 years ago, a majority of certainly of American Catholics voted for Trump. So it's a swing. I think we just need to keep reminding the Irish, as Pete Hamill used to say, where we came from. And we had our own struggles against nativism and bigotry and against immigration. And I think we need to realize that we can all be stronger together. The Jesuits have led in this respect. Reverend Father James Martin is a wonderful exponent of that theory of the Catholic Church and the social teachings of Jesus and helping the poor and helping to create more justice. That's a good message for Irish Americans, who are mostly Catholic, some of them observant. And I think we need to keep talking about that.
So in your role, if I'm correct, you are working on a committee, the Irish Americans for Biden. I'm guessing you must have done some analysis on this community, which we think is somewhere in the region of 30 million Americans who basically say, identify as Irish American. So if you were to put that corpus on the dissection table, how do they fall out? How many are Democrats? How many are Republicans? What does the anatomy of that look like?
It changes as with economic prospects and well-being. When there was a big unionization of the Irish, they tended to vote Democrat. Today, they might vote Democrat at local level, but they might move around when it comes to the presidential candidate. So it's the research on this suggests that it's a vote up for grabs in many respects. And the vote for Trump was a protest vote, It was a protest, as is populism, by people who said that capitalism wasn't working for them. They weren't as well off as they had hoped to be. They weren't, and you know, these aren't necessarily very poor people, but they just feel that they've been left behind as the rich get very rich. And many of Trump's messages, you know, were the correct ones. Stop all these foreign wars that are wasting people's lives. Stop the Chinese from exploiting us. And, you know, give people a fairer deal. He didn't obviously practice any of that. But, Joe Biden has 18 months before the next midterms to show that he can make a difference in the lives of ordinary people, be they Irish Americans or any other identity. Now, do people vote for president just because they're of their ethnic heritage? No. But it is a part of their makeup and their identity. And we know that identity politics matter as much as matters, you know, of issues of economics. That's why I think Joe Biden is very much loved, and for both his integrity and his honesty and his passion and his pride in being Irish.
So if we look at the Irish American community, the big waves of immigration start back, you know, right after the famine. Now, there were certainly Irish people that were in America before, and indeed they played a prominent role. Most of those are what would be referred to as the Scotch Irish, meaning they were of Protestant descent, whereas the big Catholic immigration, kicks off in the 1840s. And we're probably something like seven generations removed from that. And indeed, the last probably major wave of legal immigration into America by Irish people was in the 1950s. And then probably the last wave of immigration was my era, the 1980s, when many Irish people came here under undocumented status. So my impression is that we are dealing with an Irish American community now that is many generations removed or aging. And so the ability to kind of influence them, to kind of leverage that Irish soft power, seems more difficult to maintain. What should the Irish government be doing to kind of continue to maintain that soft power, given those circumstances?
Well, I'd probably give two answers to that. First one alludes back to something Kieran Cannon said on your podcast, where he talked about culture and music being the glue of the Irish American community. And certainly I know the Irish government and Consul General in New York, Kieran Madden and Dan Mulhall, the ambassador, and all the other fine diplomats are supporting that policy of promoting music and culture. Glucksman Ireland House being a good example of it. Loretta Brennan Glucksman and her late husband, you know, put millions into establishing a center of Irish studies, the Irish Arts Center. We have Boston, Notre Dame, many, many universities. So there are second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh generation Americans from Irish heritage who are studying writers like Yeats, Beckett, Sally Rooney, lots of others, and are getting caught up in Ireland that way. I think we have to do something more, though, to bring the next generation along, the younger ones. And two ideas are out there. One is to give a vote to Irish citizens in the Irish presidential election. The other one is some sort of birthright program to bring more young Irish, college age, back to Ireland for an experience. Because the research shows that if you visit Ireland once, chances are you're hooked. And obviously Israel has done a great job with that particular program. So a number of us are exploring that to see what we can done. The vote for Irish citizens abroad, I think, is of limited value because there aren't that many of the 35 million, obviously, who are Irish citizens. And voting every 7 years, won't make that big an impact. Having said that, I think some sort of vote might be a good idea. The French have a system in place, setting aside a number of seats for their diaspora, for their overseas French. you know, Billy Lawless did a great job and for the Irish diaspora when he was senator. I could imagine having somebody in the Dáil, one representative from the United States, one from Northern Ireland, one from Britain, one from the rest of the Irish, global Irish, something along those lines, I think would be very helpful to keeping the links alive. So we really have to keep thinking about this one, though, because as you say, we're aging out a little bit, and others have, you know, other ethnicities like the German one clearly aged out. So we've got to keep these connections fresh because why? Well, the Irish Americans are very important for Ireland, as we've talked about in terms of our politics and our economics, and simply because the Irish heritage is a wonderful one and needs to be nurtured and can bring so much pleasure to people who have an Irish background.
Ted's so much there. And when Martin and I were talking about this call last night, Martin said, this really needs to be a two-parter because we could look at your background and your experience. And we saw it could go in so many different directions. I think you just put the capper on the call with those last observations. And I'd like to give you a chance to do what we call a shameless plug. What in your world would you like people to know more about, and how can we help spread the word?
My shameless plug could be, I could have many of them, but the Luxman Ireland House, NYU, is having its annual virtual gala on the 23rd of February. And I hope people will register for that. You can go to Luxman Ireland House and the website and find a way to register. We're going to have great honorees, Anne Finucane, who has done so much for Ireland. She's vice chairman of Bank of America. She's going to get the Lute Luxman Award. David Barry, much loved New York Times columnist, gained the first Pete Hamill Award for outstanding journalism, and the Seamus Heaney Award, Watch This Space. Mick Maloney will be entertaining, Joni Madden, Glenn Hanser, Jimmy Galway. So it'll be a great night. I think it's something we can all look forward to.
And what's that date again, Ted?
February 23.
Right.
Thank you for asking.
Well, and you know, we have a website and we have a pretty good social media presence, so we'll be putting the word out in those ways as well.
And could I maybe, I don't know if I could finish with
yes.
Maybe reading Derek Mann's poem?
A treat. Thank you.
So, Martin and John, thanks so much for this wonderful opportunity. As we're all suffering from COVID, and it's been a really hard thing for some people, many of us have taken comfort from Derek Mann's poem, Everything is Going to Be All Right. How should I not be glad to contemplate the clouds clearing beyond the dormer window and a high tide reflected on the ceiling? There will be dying, there will be dying, but there's no need to go into that. The lines flow from the hand unbidden, and the hidden source is the watchful heart. The sun rises in spite of everything, and the far cities are beautiful and bright. I lie here in a riot of sunlight, watching the day break and the clouds flying. Everything is going to be all right. Thank you.
Thank you, Ted. Beautiful way to wrap it up.
I can't think of a better way to wrap it up, Ted. And I know John and I really enjoyed this conversation, and we'd love to have you on again because I think you sit in a place where you can best explain America to the folks in Ireland and Ireland to the folks in America. So hopefully you'll indulge us again sometime in the not too distant future.
Lots of great things there from Ted Smith. I like the way he brought our global Irish conversation around full circle towards the end there as we talked about the diaspora and a lot of related issues to the global Irish nation. How about you, Martin?
You know, what was really interesting to me was kind of just a brief moment where Ted talked about the pressure exerted on Margaret Thatcher that led to the signing of the Anglo-Irish Agreement in 1985. That point is the beginning of peace in Ireland. I left Ireland when I was 19 in 1983. My whole childhood before that the echoes of violence were a backdrop pretty much every day, even though I was living down in Dublin, some 90 miles away from Northern Ireland. So it's interesting to talk to somebody that understood exactly how Margaret Thatcher was brought to the table and how a woman who was generally considered to be, let's say, one of the toughest players in the political world at that time was brought ultimately to make peace, or at least lay the groundwork for peace. And that was special for me.
Yeah, I would say all throughout this conversation, since he was somebody with a front row seat to history throughout a lot of his career, he was like kind of throwing light into the shadows of Irish history and also of Irish life that I wouldn't have appreciated before. I thought the conversation about the growing up as a Protestant in a rural family and the different shades of communities, it's not just the Catholic Protestant divide, there are divides within the Protestants in the Republic as well. I thought it was really a fascinating perspective and amazing how that led him to a career representing the Republic of Ireland in diplomacy. And I was struck that by someone who said that life in general is a random walk, one step in front of the other. Well, he managed to do that and put together quite an amazing journey through his career. And there's that part of him that said he was looking for his place. And I think it's very encouraging that, in a sense, Ted is still looking for his place. He's looking for a place to make impact. He's looking for a place to increase understanding. And he's looking for a place that honors the global Irish community.
Hey, folks, thanks for listening. If you like what we're doing, please leave a review on your podcast platform of choice. And
if you listen to us on Apple Podcasts and aren't sure of how to post a review, we explain it all in our blog at irishstewpodcast.com.
Irish Stew is produced by John Lee, Martin Nutty, and Bill Schultz. Editing, mixing, and mastering by Bill Schultz. Music on Irish Stew was composed and performed by Rosa Nutty, with Donald Bowens on drums, Cathal O'Riordan on bass and synthesizer. For more on Rosa Nutty's music, please visit rosanutty.com.